I want to focus on the relevance of COVID-19 for our thinking about multi-level peace building and reconciliation, because COVID really has challenged peace building efforts across the globe. It's exacerbated the drivers of conflict in many places. It's disrupted peace endeavors in many locations. And so I think we need to think through the implications of COVID specifically, but also the implications of all-encompassing shocks, society-wide shocks for our understanding of peace building. And shocks, of course, can come in many forms, and some shocks are more shocking than others. I'm going to talk today particularly about pandemics, but this is hopefully an entry point into discussions about the relevance of environmental crisis, economic collapse, political upheaval, such as we've seen around Brexit in Northern Ireland, as Brandon talked about today, or the peace referendum in Colombia, as Andre talked about. These shocks come in lots and lots of different forms, and I think we need to think through the implications of these for peace building efforts. Now, I'm going to focus particularly on Rwanda today, but I'm hoping that some key features of the Rwandan case illuminate much bigger issues that I hope have some relevance for other contexts. I've been researching in Rwanda nearly every year for the last 20 years. I've been conducting longitudinal research in the same 12 communities since 2003. And this includes doing fieldwork in Rwanda during COVID last year as part of a book that I'm working on at the moment. So I'm going to draw very heavily on that recent period of fieldwork. And I think that the Rwandan government is right when it says that COVID is Rwanda's biggest challenge since the genocide against the Tutsi in 1994. This is a country that, as many will know, has gone through, I think, a pretty remarkable transformation in that period. And yet COVID, I think, really has rocked the society to its foundations in ways that I'll talk about in just a moment. I'm going to very briefly focus on four issues in this presentation. And Gwen, I know, is a justifiably very strict chair, so she's going to keep me to 20 minutes on this. I firstly want to say something about how I think, based on my research, everyday Rwandans interpret the concept of reconciliation. Secondly, I want to look at how Rwanda has pursued reconciliation with, I would argue, considerable success. Thirdly, I'll look at how COVID has challenged this. And then fourthly, I want to point to some broader lessons from this experience for context around the world. So four parts to this presentation. Let me begin by just briefly discussing how I think my respondents in Rwanda since 2003 have talked about reconciliation. I think one of the things we have to recognize right at the outset is that Rwanda is quite remarkable in the sense that, unlike all of its neighbors, it has not experienced mass violence on its territory since the genocide in 1994. That might seem like a very simple thing to point out, but it's remarkable how often that's overlooked in the story of Rwanda's trajectory since the genocide. And I think it's particularly remarkable when you put it in the context of hundreds of thousands of convicted genocide perpetrators now living side by side with genocide survivors on densely crowded hills, because that's the socioeconomic, that's the demographic reality of Rwanda today. Now, of course, Rwanda has been embroiled in conflict elsewhere in the region, and it's undoubtedly been a generator of conflict outside of its borders. But I think it's important to begin with the reality of what has happened inside the country since 94. One of the very strong refrains coming through my research since 2003, across the ethnic divide with actors at all levels of Rwandan society and follow-up interviews in the same communities over many years, is a very strong desire for something much more than peaceful coexistence. I was particularly struck by Brandon's comments about some skepticism about peaceful coexistence as the ultimate endpoint in a place like Northern Ireland. The concept of peaceful existence is treated with enormous suspicion in Rwanda, mainly because between 1973 and 1994, many people would characterize that period as one of peaceful coexistence. But of course, it was a period in which serious divisions and tensions in Rwandan society were left addressed and laid the seeds for the genocide in 1994. So there's a real suspicion about peaceful coexistence. Now, this I think is important. We see that reconciliation has real purchase in the Rwandan terrain. In a second, I'll talk about the specific components of that, but I want to situate this debate about peaceful coexistence and reconciliation in the literature at the moment, because many of you will be familiar, and Andre and I have been talking about this for a very long time. There's a very strong literature on what is now known as agonistic peace building or agonistic reconciliation, which basically says that the best that post-conflict societies can hope for is to create spaces for non-violent dialogue. And that most calls for reconciliation involve overly romantic, overly optimistic attempts to fundamentally resolve past conflicts and past identities. And so for that reason, there's this emphasis on basically people continuing the conflicts of the past, but in a non-violent fashion, and a very heavy emphasis on dialogue. Now, to simplify things, in the Rwandan context, most of my respondents would dismiss that argument out of hand and would say, that's not enough for us. We need to aim for something more than that. We do need to rebuild and reconceive relationships at all levels of society in completely different ways. And also, talk is not enough. The agonistic emphasis on dialogue alone is insufficient. One of the things that runs all through my research in Rwanda is a very strong emphasis that reconciliation involves action. It involves cooperation. It involves engagement. So we've got the agonistic literature, which I would argue we should be skeptical of. I think it's insufficiently robust. I think it's insufficiently optimistic. It narrows the parameters of what certain societies may be able to achieve or believe is important. More broadly, I would say in the literature, or much of the literature, reconciliation is becoming a bit of a dirty word. Some of you may have even seen recently a special issue in the Journal of the Royal Anthropological Institute with a piece by Richard Wilson on the theme of irreconciliation, the idea that that conflicts are often so intractable that reconciliation is simply fanciful. And so I think the Rwandan experience, at least my respondents, I think would challenge that kind of view as well. To summarize, the view of reconciliation that I think comes out of at least my Rwandan research is that this is not a romantic concept at all. It's incredibly practical. And I often ask my respondents, what would reconciliation look like? What are we looking for at different levels of society? And they emphasize very practical things. We eat and drink together. We work together on each other's farms, very heavy emphasis on cooperative agricultural activities. We attend each other's weddings and funerals. We help each other during illness. Now I'll come back to that because that's particularly salient in the COVID context. And we help each other during other crises that befall members of our community. So these are not romantic. These are not abstract things. These are very concrete day-to-day activities that many of my respondents believe signifies that reconciliation is starting to take place. And it's something practically that should be aimed for. And in much of my work, I've argued that I think actually Rwanda has made substantial strides in achieving this kind of reconciliation. So then secondly, how has Rwanda gone about this? In a multi-level sense, because that's the emphasis of our conference today, what are the mutually reinforcing processes at different levels of Rwandan society that have been important in pursuing reconciliation? And I, in a very schematic way, want to suggest that there are three crucial processes that do different things at different levels. One has been the Gacaca community courts. 12,000 village trials between 2002 and 2012 that prosecuted 400,000 genocide cases. I think what's particularly important about this enormous, imperfect, unruly, unpredictable process of village justice, which I followed for all of those 10 years, is that they firstly created a really important space for open contestation and confrontation between community members about the past and about the future. And also that it delivered punitive justice. Now, this is something we haven't talked about too much today, the importance of punishment. That in the Rwandan case, not just in the genocide survivor community, but even in some segments of the perpetrator community, there is a sense that for perpetrators to go back and live peacefully on the hills with their neighbors, that there needs to have been some sense of direct reckoning with the past and some kind of punishment. And Rwanda used a very creative form of punishment, particularly community service through Gacaca to do so. And I think that Gacaca process, getting these crimes out in the open, generating a public debate and delivering a very tangible form of justice to genocide perpetrators was incredibly important for the overall pursuit of reconciliation. The second crucial process towards reconciliation that Rwanda has embarked on is a really systematic welfare system. Now, this is something that we often don't hear in debates about Rwanda. What is remarkable, I think, about the Rwandan story over the last 28 years, with all of its problems, with all of its political conflicts, its increasing, I would say, authoritarianism, is that this very illiberal state has in fact delivered the most systematic welfare program in the region. One indicator of that is that in the space of 15 years, Rwanda halved its child mortality rate because of massive investment in healthcare and health services. So that, of course, reduces the fear of death in the context of childbirth, a really important issue for well-being and people's ability to think about the future. But crucially, and this is one of the things that I've been mapping in my research since 2003, is a very sustained sense at the local level, especially in rural areas, that state welfare in healthcare, education, and other areas has drastically decreased socioeconomic inequality across the ethnic divide. And I can't overstate the importance of this, that when Kagame stands up and says, we are all Rwandans now, and we need to overcome ethnic identity and embrace a sense of the Rwandan identity, many of my Hutu respondents are very suspicious of that kind of dialogue or that kind of discourse, except when they see that there is some tangible reality in their day-to-day life. Their own socioeconomic uplift matches this rhetoric of a greater sense of Rwandanness. And it has numerous other problems, but at least in socioeconomic terms, this, I think, has been absolutely essential to dealing with some of the key drivers of the genocide in 1994. What's crucial here, too, is that in discussions about socioeconomic inequality after 1994, people often point to Rwanda's very drastic Gini coefficient, but that, I think, shrouds a much more important reality. That is often a Gini coefficient generated by the disjunct between the socioeconomic reality in Kigali and the socioeconomic reality out in the rural areas. And undoubtedly, there is a massive gulf there. But that's not how the vast majority of rural respondents understand inequality. They don't compare themselves with people living in Kigali because it may as well be another planet. They compare themselves with their neighbors. And there we are seeing a high degree of equality manifesting, especially in the last 20 years. And many of my Hutu respondents tell me very openly, they never expected Kagame and the RPF to do this. They expected that a minority Tutsi government would do what every previous Rwandan regime had done, which was to favor their own ethnic group. And they're pleasantly surprised by what they've experienced under the RPF. Now, they're fearful of the RPF in many other respects, government surveillance, repression, the rest of it. But on these really important socioeconomic terms, there has been, I think, some really important improvements there. And I was going to give examples of and share a couple of anecdotes, but I'm aware of the time. The third, I think, important process contributing to reconciliation in Rwanda is at the community level. So we've got Gacaca, which was a state orchestrated community-based approach. We've got the welfare system, which is delivered by the state. But below the purview of the state after Gacaca, we've seen a range of really important informal, locally driven processes with a key emphasis on dialogue. There's this huge national patchwork of associations, student clubs, economic cooperatives, church groups, you name it. You go to any community in Rwanda and there'll be 20 of these groups who meet every week, sometimes multiple times a week, to talk about current and historical problems. And I've sat in on hundreds of these meetings. And in many respects, they replicate much of the discourse of Gacaca. We're going to meet in open spaces and talk about the underlying problems in our community, and we're going to seek some kind of collective solution to that. These are quieter, less visible forms of reconciliation between individuals and groups. And I think they crucially complement what we've seen at the national level. So there are multiple processes at different levels performing complementary peace and reconciliation related dimensions. And I think it's when you put these things together with it, we start to get a sense of why Rwanda is where it is today. The third big theme of this lecture then is what has COVID done to all of this? And I think the crux here is that COVID has really challenged the basis of reconciliation that was laid by those three really important processes. The reasons for this are probably pretty self-evident in many respects. one crucial impact of COVID in Rwanda, and it should be said that Rwanda dealt with COVID pretty well. Its numbers were very, very low, but it came at an enormous cost, particularly in terms of the collapse of the formal and the informal economies, leading to massive food insecurity. Now, I was locked down with my wife and three children. I have to say, having COVID this week is not a patch on being locked down with my wife and three children aged under six. We were locked down in Kigali at two different junctures over 5 months. I was in the countryside most of the time, but in the lockdowns, I was obviously in Kigali and also doing much more research in Kigali than I've done in a long time because of lockdown. I've never seen so much begging in Rwanda in my 20 years of going there. There is a real cultural opposition in Rwanda to begging, especially from foreigners. There is a deep cultural discourse around self-reliance. Now, COVID pushed people to the edge because many people really were on the brink of starvation, especially in Kigali. Now, this, I think, is important for understanding the impact of COVID and our thinking about shocks, is that there wasn't uniform impact of COVID across the country. Particularly, there was a big rural and urban divide. One of the things that was really striking during my fieldwork in the countryside last year was the substantial resilience of rural communities, in both in a socioeconomic but in a relational sense during COVID, in contrast to what was going on in Kigali. And I think that this wasn't only about COVID. I think it points to the fact that those three reconciliation contributing processes I meant before perhaps had taken greater root in rural areas. There had been much higher gachacha turnouts in the countryside. There tends to be less government surveillance of people's everyday interactions in the countryside. Maybe that's helped rural communities get further along the pathway towards reconciliation. But crucially, during COVID, one of the things that became so important was that rural communities could continue to grow food and they could continue to eat, in contrast to urbanites, particularly in Kigali, who could do no such thing. And one of the ways that this manifest was suddenly there were rural to urban remittances. So many of my rural respondents were sending mobile money and sometimes even, despite the lockdown restrictions, smuggling food to their relatives in Kigali. One of my long-term respondents is a convicted genocide perpetrator. In my research, I call him Cypriot. He laughed when he told me the lengths that he'd gone to get tomatoes, maize, and bananas to his relatives in Kigali and Nyagatari, which is one of the other big towns. This guy is seriously clever and he has all sorts of connections and networks and he made them work to his advantage. The UN Food Program should sign Cypriot up immediately. But that was the kind of thing that was happening in many, many rural communities, completely reversing the trend of remittances from rural to urban areas. And this is where I think Graham Simpson's presentation on the previous panel really struck a chord with me when he talked about urban youth, not just youth, but specifically urban youth, because I think there's a big problem that COVID has created in the Rwandan context amongst youth living in Kigali. These were an urban poor that was already poor before COVID. In the midst of COVID, there was massive land expropriation and housing destruction that was happening right across Kigali. This is part of the rejuvenation of Kigali for Kagame's vision 2050. And so this was producing huge anger, particularly amongst those living in Kigali and particularly amongst young people who had been promised that the economic growth and the opportunities that many people had experienced since 1994 would continue ad infinitum. And COVID absolutely put the brakes on that. And it certainly put the brakes on the Rwandan welfare system, which many people had relied on very heavily up until then. To summarize, I think the major impact of COVID in terms of peace building and reconciliation in Rwanda was that it created a huge amount of psychosocial trauma for people. It put a huge stress on community relations. A mantra in so many of my interviews, especially in Kigali, was that people had become selfish. They had stopped caring about others. There was a huge amount of anger directed towards the government because of the breakdown in the welfare system. Last week I was talking to some colleagues of mine who work on sociotherapy in Rwanda, and they're saying that this has been the toughest year that they can remember around the commemoration period in April. But because of COVID, they've seen a drastic increase in people's trauma and a real weakening of many community relations. I think the reason for this is that COVID, in many respects, directly undermined the way that Rwanda had specifically gone about reconciliation. So much of Rwanda's recovery has been based on an idea of proximity, of people engaging directly with one another, whether that was through Gacaca, whether that was through community dialogues. It wasn't agonistic. It wasn't about sort of expecting that you couldn't get to a more optimistic future. It was much more in your face than that. There was a high degree of engagement. And also a sustained welfare program had been really important in this respect. Well, COVID challenged both of that. Lockdown meant that people couldn't visit one another. People started muttering about each other. And also many people were locked down in their homes. There was drone surveillance in Kigali and in some villages. People would suddenly look up in the sky and there would be a government drone hovering over their house, which was hugely shaming for them in the community because their neighbors started muttering about what that family was doing to contravene the strictures of the lockdown. So I would argue, and I'm being schematic here because of the time, that Rwanda's come a long way in terms of reconciliation, but because of COVID, I would say it's a country currently in flux. There's a serious process of reorientation going on. I would say most acutely in Kigali, but it's there in the countryside as well. And those 28 years of hard work on reconciliation are really being profoundly challenged. In 2 minutes, Gwen, please forgive me. Why is this important beyond Rwanda? I think it's crucial that I talk about Rwanda in detail because I think these things, the impact of COVID is so profoundly important for that society. But I also think that there are things too that we should keep an eye on in other contexts. And let me literally deliver them as bullet points. The first one is we've got to be prepared for shocks when we think about peace building and reconciliation. Expect the unexpected. We have to build shocks more systematically into peace building and reconciliation theory and practice. As Tanya said earlier today, and I think it was such a crucial point, peace building is perpetual. It's never a set piece process. It's ongoing. And I look forward to Cedric's presentation in a minute on adaptive peace. Peace building has to be multifaceted and dynamic within the same society. There are different actors at different levels who have different needs, and those needs change over time. And peace building and reconciliation have to respond in that sense. One of the things that comes through very strongly, I think, in the Rwandan case is that we've got to focus on Kigali. And I think that there has been a tendency sometimes to think that the great economic boom of the city was going to carry so many people. Well, I think it's leaving people behind. COVID has exacerbated that, and that has huge repercussions for reconciliation. So there's a whole analysis to be done about the links between peace building and urbanization. Peace building also requires care. And I think this is a really important word that comes out of my research, is that, and again, I think this is in contrast to much of what we see in the agonistic literature. We have a huge amount to learn from social work and anthropology about how we conceptualize care and how it connects to reconciliation at all levels of society. And that includes care for individuals. This is why I think Ufra's presentation was also so important, because it got us to think about how much peace and reconciliation is national, community level, group-based, but it's also about individuals and their psychological and their material circumstances. And then finally, looking beyond the Rwandan context, reconciliation, I think, still has purchase in so many settings. This is a term, it's not a dirty term. It shouldn't be automatically dismissed as romantic and impractical. Now, we have to admit, sometimes in the literature, we've talked about reconciliation in romantic ways. So people who have thought that it's an important context have sometimes been their own worst enemy here. But I think the Rwandan case shows that this is not a fanciful, abstract term. It's got real purchase. It's got real solidity to it. And at least amongst my respondents over the last 20 years, reconciliation's absolutely seen, not as a choice, but as an imperative. Thanks very much.